Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
Ooh, baby, I'm a love man. That's what they call me, I'm a love man.
Bob Carlyle was introduced to Christian music early in the 70s during the time of the Jesus Movement in Southern California. He appeared with several early Jesus music acts, including Allies, and sang backup vocals on sessions with Brian Duncan, Vince Ebo, Sandy Patty, and Petra, before signing with Sparrow Records, also as a solo artist himself. Of course, Bob's life changed forever with the chart-topping success of Butterfly Kisses. And from the very little I know about Bob, some of those changes were good, and some maybe not so much. Well, let's get to the bottom of it, folks. Where has this guy been all my life? Bob Carlyle on the Drew Marshall Show. Bob.
Yo.
Has anyone ever told you you look like a better-looking version of Ricky Gervais?
Actually, yes.
Thank you.
You know, I'm speaking to you from the top of my penthouse suite in Las Vegas, where I have very little human contact now. I'm happy to reach out to you.
Thank you. To the little people. Thank you. Thank you.
Let the little people upon whose heads I stood to achieve my success.
I have been wanting to interview Bob Carlyle since the day I was sitting in the Blues Club, downtown Nashville, Printer's Alley with Brian Duncan watching Daryl Mansfield try out some local blues men. And Brian leans over to me and he says, Hey, you see that guy? He just walked in and sat down by himself at the bar? Now there's a guy you should have on your show. Talk about messy Christianity. And of course, that guy was you.
Yeah. Hell, consider the source, Drew.
Yeah,
Consider the source, my friend. A sociopath will say anything to further his cause.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm glad that this moment has finally arrived, honestly. From the little I know about you, you shoot straight, you tell it like it is, you've had your ups, you've had your downs, and if you're okay with sharing your guts, then I think we should go for it. What do you reckon?
I'm okay with it, Drew. I don't really stand on a soapbox because really, you know, after 30 some years of being a Christian, I found the soapbox to be quite too far to fall from. But I'll share whatever I can.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate it. We've had a few messy Jesus people on the show that you would know. Of course, Brian would be one of them. Let's talk about another buddy of yours, Rick Elias.
Yeah. Rick is. He's a great, great dear friend, and really one of the great wits of our society. No one has made me gut laugh and have to stand up holding my crotch to keep from peeing like Ricky Elias, okay. The funniest man in the universe.
Great, thanks for that visual.
Thank you. There you go. Good morning.
Appreciate it. Good morning. Morning. Uh-huh. Now let's go to maybe the captain of the messy Jesus people ship, Delilah. She says, hello, by the way. I spoke with her yesterday, and she said, please give my love to what's your name again? Bob Carlyle.
Yeah, Delilah was a dear heart, man, during the whole Butterfly Kisses phenomenon. She was a big friend and really went above and beyond the call of duty to help promote that record, that song, and me. It was great.
Yeah. Now, here's something I don't know. I can't wrap my head around this. I can't imagine you, Brian Duncan, touring together with Mr. Ten Commandments, Kirk Cameron, on the Left Behind tour. I just can't. I don't know. There's my brain melts when I think of that.
Well, I met Kirk Cameron back. I used to be a partner in a large record company / distribution / publishing company, which I had no business being in, but I did anyway. And we had this distribution rights to the whole Left Behind film series, and I got to know Kirk Cameron from the shooting of those films, and the tour was kind of, I guess, to somehow bolster that record, the soundtrack album that was on the Left Behind film soundtrack, and Brian had some songs on there as well, so I guess we were all kind of out there communally trying to sell something.
Well, good. I'm glad you were communally doing things together. That's very, very communal of you.
Kirk Cameron's a wonderful guy. He's really a human guy. I really don't know much about him other than the contact that I had with him years ago, but I know that he's still really involved in the whole Christian media thing. But he's a very, very at the time that I knew him, he was very, very absorbing, listening to people talk and wanting to learn everything he could.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
All right, first question really kind of comes out of the gate. Dude, where'd you go? I mean, there's hardly anything out there online about you. Your website has some weird random stuff about dogs and parasites and folding tables.
I noticed that. My website, the what do you call it, the lease on it, whatever it is.
the
hold on the website expired, and I guess the people who were managing it 12 years ago are now no longer in my life and off the face of the planet, and they had to have them to reinstate it, so I couldn't get it reinstated, so somebody just snatched it up.
Wow.
I don't know why. I don't know what it is. Some dog lover site with Bob Carlisle on it. I didn't really make the connection, but I haven't really made a great attempt to regain the site, only because I really hadn't paid much attention to it over the last decade, and so, you know, it was something it was out there, and I guess it was a good source for people to know how to get a hold of me and my management, but I never really updated it much, and, you know, so I haven't been really proactive in getting it back up. I probably should.
Okay, well, enough about the website. Where the heck did you go?
Well, I'm old people, Drew. after butterfly kisses?
So, wait, are you saying you went out and bought yourself a nice golden shuffleboard set?
Kinda. Yeah, not exactly wrong. We sold 3 million records, and I was very grateful for that. And you know, I was the writer and producer of all the songs, and we were very, very fortunate, and with the sales of that record. And I have since done a couple of albums. We put out one more album, and then we put out the Best Of album, and I just haven't been motivated to do another record. I don't know. Sometimes I think, you know, Jesus only had to say it once. I'm trying to figure out, you know, new and more and exciting ways to tell the same story. Not that it isn't completely wonderful and relevant in my life, but I just kind of got burnt out, you know. And during that time, I'd done so much touring and so much traveling and so much publicity, and I really wanted to kind of seek a place for my wife and I to retire. We're kind of semi-retired, I guess.
Good for you. Good for you.
I've got grandchildren and the whole thing. Now.
Come on. Bob Carlisle has grandchildren?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. I got a 4-year-old grandson and a 2-year-old granddaughter. But I still own a nice recording studio in Las Vegas where I live. And so I still work on music a lot and write for other artists, do a lot of writing. But I just haven't, I don't know, man. I don't really know the answer. I just haven't been motivated to go out there. Well, for one thing, I just turned 54, and the average age of a Christian artist now is 12. I don't really want to go out and compete in that market anymore.
Okay, hold on. I got to interject. I'm an audio guy because I'm a radio guy, so my ears are always trained to different frequencies than the rest of the world most of the time.
Yeah.
And what I'm picking up here is, first of all, you sound exactly like Larry Norman. I had about a 2-hour interview with Larry. I know. Good luck with that one. But before Larry died, obviously, I had this killer long interview with him. And I'm just going, man, he sounds like Larry, right? So, and then that reminded me of this question, which I don't know. I just think you'll probably answer it the same way that Larry did. I said to Larry Norman, so Larry, when are you going to release your worship CD? Everybody seems to have a worship CD these days. How about you? And I sort of asked it facetiously, and Larry said, never.
Yeah, there was a trend there for a while everybody was releasing their worship CDs. All these trends come because, I mean, not that a great worship CD isn't wonderful. I mean, I like to worship as much as anybody, but it becomes record companies kind of follow trends. Record companies don't know what the next thing is going to be. They never do. So they're always chasing it. And so somebody puts out a successful worship CD, and it works. Suddenly everybody's putting out a worship CD. When I hit the top of the pop charts, top of the AC charts, at number one for 7 weeks, you know, everybody's going, all right, give me a 45-year-old fat father of two. That's the new thing. But record companies really don't know. You know, I don't really want to follow trends anymore. I don't want to jump back into the contemporary Christian market in that it's a very, very selective and
Yeah. Well, and that's why I've got you in the show, because if you were the other way, you and I would never have talked.
Well, you know, the average age, I did own a record company for a while, which is a really stupid thing on my part, but because I don't have any business doing that. But,
yeah.
You know, they say, how do you lose $1 million in the music business? Start with two.
Well, bump, yes.
I did that very well. And, it's all about what's the newest, youngest, prettiest,
cute,
well-packaged, young, yeah, young fashion statement slash Christian artist. And I don't fit the mold. Not that I ever did, really. I was very fortunate at the time that I got into Christian music. It was a little bit, people really, record companies back in my day, invested in the artist and who they were and in long-term relationships, and that just doesn't happen anymore.
No, no, they don't even know how to spell relationship.
No, I don't think so.
Speaking of relationship, do you remember that night when you and I actually didn't meet? But do you remember that night that Daryl Mansfield was trying out
I remember a night, yeah, I remember a night we'd done something else. We'd performed somewhere else.
Yeah,
a week or something in Nashville. And
yeah, was it some back room of some club? Like Ray Ware was there and Daryl.
Yeah, Ray's my manager.
Yep,
and
Phil Kagi,
right? And Ashley Cleveland.
Yeah, it was a good night, actually. It was a very good night.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Yeah, I remember that, and then everybody kind of fell out, you know, where do we go? And there's this blues club in Printer's Alley, and Brian said they're going to be over there, so I popped in, and
yeah,
Daryl was up playing his harp, and it was kind of a cool thing. I didn't stay for very long, but it was a cool event. I do remember that.
All right, let's go back, all right? Let's take it way back here. Santa Ana, California.
Oh, boy.
Santa Ana, okay. Which is actually, is that not where you are right now? Are you back in Santa Ana?
Yeah,
right?
I'm in Santa Ana right now. My mother has fallen on some ill health. She's fine, but she had recently had a heart attack and had a pacemaker put in. So my wife and I are down here in Santa Ana looking after her for a while.
Good for you.
We live in Las Vegas.
Okay, so Santa Ana, California, 7 years old, you're taking private lessons, you're learning how to play guitar, read music, and then you learn the art of orchestration and arranging. Boy, you must have been a fun hang.
Oh, actually, I was, man, because nobody messes with a guy who's in the band.
Oh, well, that's true.
I was the guy who provided the sounds for all the parties, man. Everybody loved me.
You're right. Okay, all right. So, but who was... What or who was driving all this? Like, did you have a dad like Tiger Woods, or was this passion built into your hard drive?
It was really built into my hard drive, I guess. My dad was he saw the gift in me that I was musical, and but he was never lashing a whip at me. He was always like, if you want to pursue this, let's do it correctly and really learn, you know, how to do it. And anytime you want to stop, you know, tell me, and we'll stop. But if you want to continue it, we're going to do it the right way. And the passion just built in me over the years, and just evolved as it does in every musician who has a heart for it, and bands and writing. And although I listened to some of my old songs, and they were just unforgivable.
All right. You know. Apparently, you were, if I get this right, you were about to join Luciano Placido and the other guy when out of nowhere, three other guys messed you up forever, right? And I'm talking about the legal soul firm of Otis Redding, or maybe we'll just say Redding, Pickett, and Brown.
Yeah, they did. You know, I was a little white kid on the block, and I was practicing my guitar, and people could hear it through the windows of the house. One day this lowrider showed up in front of my house. I think it was out, little Bobby. Raking the leaves in front of this lowrider, pull up in front of my house with three guys with beanies down over their noses. And he said, hey, you want to be in a band? And I said, well, sure. And they gave me, you know, three or four albums. Said, learn this. We'll be back.
Sure.
It was Wilson Pickett and Tower of Power and Otis Redding and Sly and the Family Stone and learned it. I was indoctrinated into the world of Latin soul and funk, and I always just loved it.
That's cool.
I was the anti-white kid.
You know, since you're such a fan of James Brown, I have locked away in the vault a half-hour interview I did with him just before he died. And his manager said it's the longest interview he's ever given. But boy, that was a highlight for me, interviewing James Brown, man. It was cool.
You think?
Yeah.
Man, where did you start with questions? You must have had that lined up.
Yeah, I think I started with, hey man, who does your hair?
Yeah, yeah. Why the name James Brown?
Yeah.
How'd you get started playing music?
Have you listened to my show? That's just that's an uncanny impersonation of me.
So tell us how you got started.
Yeah, seriously. Okay, 1993, you sang this. Take my heart, take my soul. Take me anywhere you want to go. I want to walk on the road you choose, so I'll follow you. Change my mind, change it now. Turn my whole whole world upside down. I got a new kind of love, and you got me mind, body, heart, and soul.
Yeah, that was from my first solo release from Sparrow, which is now EMI, Christian Music. That was from the first solo release. I guess it was something of a hit in the Christian music realm.
Okay, but what's...
Christian music are different than hits and secular music.
Yeah.
They don't pay full time. And, you know, it's a whole different... You can be number one in Christian music and sell 75,000 units. Everybody's just putting your picture on the wall.
Yeah, no, you were right when you said 75 units.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's your response? Thinking back in those lyrics...
Yeah.
1993, right? You just heard what I read. You got the lyrics. You know, yeah. What's your response when you think back on those lyrics?
Well, my songs have always been, and that one even in particular, have always been about my rebellion and not really wanting to do what everybody says I should do. I've always had to learn my lessons from God with number two sledgehammers. I've never gone down easily. But I've learned, when I learned those lessons, I learned them very well. And that was, you know, just a pivotal point of letting go. And I used to be, you know, playing clubs and bar rooms and as a musician and playing the most awful toilets you can imagine. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. There's some very good, honest, working musicians who do that. But I got so caught up in it that I was, you know, self-medicating, staying drunk most of the time and just to get through it, and I just had it with spinning my wheels. I didn't know why. I knew I was a Christian since I was 16 years old, and I knew that there was something for me to do other than, you know, playing music for people to barf to, but I just didn't know what it was until I just learned how to completely lay it down and walk away.
You've just actually described in a sort of Freudian way the contemporary Christian music scene, music to barf to. So well done.
Well,
that was good.
I haven't listened to contemporary Christian music in 10 years or more. I people tell me about these new artists, and you know them. I go, man, no. And all the artists that I knew are now, you know, either pastors of churches or retired or
dead.
Yeah, they're dead. Exactly.
Well, I mean, guys that influenced me back in the day, well, the top two would be Larry Norman, lyrically, musically.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he has got lots of backstories, somewhat like you were alluding to there, or maybe Brian alluded to me a little bit more. He loves gossiping about you. Can I just say that?
Oh, yeah, that's fine. You know, we're all in that club of people that we're bruised fruit, man. We're used goods.
Another guy from back in the day, Mark Hurd.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the king of the bruised fruit, I think.
Yeah, and that whole scene, those guys were all kind of part of that scene of just coming out and saying, look, we're human beings here who are saved by a ridiculous amount of grace. It's a careful line to walk, because you don't want to go also and showcase your questions so much, you know, because a lot of that can be turned into no longer something that's worthwhile. It can turn into something that's kind of annoying.
Yeah.
And so I'm a walk careful line. I remember Larry Norman. My meetings with Larry Norman were few but memorable. I met him in Europe a couple of times. He's always hanging out somewhere in Europe in some little town in a house with a windmill somewhere.
Yeah, the Towheads loved him, man. The Dutch or Netherlands or the Germans.
They loved him, man. And I've had a few interesting conversations with him. And I didn't really get him that much, but, you know, he sure made a big splash with everybody. I recently heard that he passed away, and it was a real sad thing, because he really had been so effective in the lives of people who don't walk in the mold of what cleaned up, packaged Christianity is supposed to look like.
Those are back in the days of love offerings. Remember those? Where you got you got a lot of love, but very few offerings, right?
There wasn't enough love, at least not in the offerings.
No.
There was nowhere to tour, and we were touring up and down the Southern California coast. That was it, because Christian music back then, well, it kind of is still today. Remember when you were a kid and used to get your dad to get you that toolbox to look just like his?
Yeah.
And it had all the smaller versions of hammers and screwdrivers and wrenches. And on the top of the little toolbox, it said, just like Dad. And that's kind of what Christian music was for a long time, just like real music. just like Dad. You know, if the police came out and everybody was making a police-sounding record. Bruce Hornsby came out and everybody was making Bruce Hornsby, so we're just like Dad. And it was, I'm guilty as anybody else of doing that. You know, it was always known to be an alternative.
Yeah,
I liked it back when it was just a ministry, and not so much an alternative to anything. The alternative thing got caught up in itself. Now I think there's more of a scene of artists just being artists, you know. But I've just kind of stayed clear of the whole business of contemporary Christian music because I don't really understand it anymore. God bless them. You know, I hope they have all the success in the world and. I don't quite understand it anymore, so I just rather than throw rocks at it, I just keep my distance.
On the phone with Bob Carlisle, a more gracious man than I am, that's for sure. When you look back on the Allies days, there must be some fond memories. Like, I'm thinking in particular of the pant-splitting incident.
Oh, God, yeah, an enormous, enormous, enormous error. the pant-splitting was...
I hope those two incidents aren't combined.
They are, and it was... It was the past winning incident was just world known. It was for you to even bring it up now, and I'll still get an email once every 5 years or somebody that just says, "Hey man, I was there.
I was there.
I saw it." Yeah.
When
I was there that night. It was the most embarrassing thing that could happen to a lead singer in a band that you could possibly imagine. Need I elaborate?
Yes, please do.
Oh well, I was in a. I forget where we were playing in Southern California. The place was absolutely jam-packed with a new young rock band sensation, and the place is just sweating with people chanting loud. It's a perfect Spinal Tap rock and roll pre-show scenario, and we're just absolutely out of our minds excited. And, and the place was just chanting for us, and we mount the stage. Of course, we're called Allies, so we're all wearing these sort of pseudo military garb, real tight, because that's back when I was real skinny, and we had real long, long, enormously triumphant pompadours and mullets.
Yeah.
And triumphant or majestic is the word that comes to mind. and we... I come out and start this tune. The band is just killing, and the audience is just nuts. And I decide in my stupid little angst young rock and roll head to do some sort of a, what would be in my mind, some sort of a James Brown move, a splits move on stage. And I'd never done it before, so no, let's go ahead and just try it for the first time on stage. I went down for it, and my pants ripped from... You know, it wasn't just like one of those, you know, it's a little rip in your pants. It was from stem to stern, from belt to crotch, man. Just a slap it in the wind, man. And probably wasn't wearing the most complimentary underwear.
No, that was back in the days of tidy whities, you know.
And the drummer, our drummer Jimmy Erickson, I didn't really know what was happening, man. But suddenly the drums fell apart, sticks. Flying everywhere, and tears were protruding vertically out of his head, laughing so hard, man. And I realized that I feel this flapping in the wind. And so, you know, the band's just playing hard and heavy, and I just sidestepped my way off the stage, and I'm in the side wings, and the band's doing drum solo. Keep quiet, laugh solo. And I don't know what to do. What do I do here? You know, I didn't bring any extra clothes. And some guy comes up and goes, "Man, listen. Well, about your size, I think I got so I can help you." I'll go, "Oh, thank you, brother, please." And he runs out and gets a pair of Levi corduroy purple Maxi Bell flood pants. and I put them on, and, you know, they came up to my shins, and they were maxi belts, and I'm wearing army boots, and I look like some sort of gay Captain Kirk thing, and continued the concert with this ridiculous thing going on, it was just terrible, and I finished the whole night with it like that, and I apparently... rationalize it somehow to the audience.
Yeah, thank you for that moment. That brought to you by Bob Carlisle, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
I can imagine, for some reason, I don't know why I'm thinking about this, but remember Captain Kirk used to get into fights with his buddy from the Academy, Finnegan or Flanagan?
Yes, I do.
Remember that? And they'd punch each other. That's those kind of pants. That's what I think about.
Oh, yeah. They were like maxi bells only up to their shins. And with the boots just kind of in an olive oil protrusion down out of the bell with olive oil feet. And remember from Popeye.
Thanks for that. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. It was as you can imagine, or worse.
Or worse. You and Tom Kelly, Billy Steinberg wrote True Colors, which, of course, Cyndi Lauper turned into, I think, a bit of a hit.
Yeah, you know what? I wish I could say that I wrote it with those guys, but I didn't. I knew those guys real well. They wrote tons and tons of hits.
Yeah, but you didn't?
Like a Virgin and How Do I Get You Alone for Hard. Wrote just tons of hits. And I'd worked with them a lot playing on their demos for stuff. And I played on and sang on the demo for that to get it to a Cyndi Lauper.
Okay, so let me just get the facts right, because I don't want to wreck a good story with facts. You sang the demo that these guys wrote, which went over to Cyndi Lauper, and she turned into a hit. Did I get that right?
There you go.
Boom.
There you go.
What'd you do with, now I'm nervous about my information. Why'd you come in here looking like that? That, of course, Dolly Parton picked that up.
Oh, wrote that one. Okay. Maggie Thomas. And that got to Dolly Parton, and that was a number one hit for her, and that's what bought my house in Nashville.
Nice. Here's a little quote from you. The song Butterfly Kisses was written for my daughter, Brooke. I was struck late one night with the reality that my baby girl had grown up and she would be leaving my home soon. The joy of happy memories and the burden of missed opportunities collided in my heart, and the song just poured out. When I wrote it, I never expected it to be recorded. I was content for it to be my private love letter to Brooke. I'm thrilled at its success, but it's strange to hear a song written for your daughter being played on the radio. It's even stranger to hear the song covered by another artist.
Yeah, I'd written it for my daughter just prior to her 16th birthday. I'd come home late from touring from the airport or something and went into my office in the house. And in my office were hiding. My wife had hidden some things that were the trappings of what was going to be kind of a sweet 16 party. There were photos, and that's where the pictures came from, leading her on a horse on a pony ride and a lopsided cake and all those things. And I just fell apart and wrote the thing almost in its entirety in one carpet tear-stained evening, and I gave it to my daughter on, you might remember these, it was on a cassette.
Yes.
I gave it to her on a cassette, and she carried it around in her purse for, gosh, a year before anybody else even heard it. So one day I had some guys from the record company over to my home to listen to some material that I was proposing for my next record, and my wife had said, play him Butterfly Kisses. And I said, no. Nobody wants to hear a sappy song about a guy and his daughter. Come on, get over it. Said, no, play Butterfly Kisses. And nobody wants to hear this. It's just that, you know, I can't even face them if I play it. And I saw it. She said, play it. So I put it on. I left the room. I left the room while they listened to it, and I came back into the room when it was over, and everybody's just with their heads between their knees, just bawling and squalling, and I thought, wow. I didn't even know if anybody else in this world knew what a butterfly kiss was. I thought it was maybe just some dysfunctional thing we did. So apparently enough people knew to bring it home. And I, you know, having as a songwriter, it's the greatest compliment you can receive is for someone to take something that you've written and make it their own in their own hearts. That's such a compliment. I'm so grateful for that.
Someone once told me that song blessed you and cursed you. It almost ruined you. True?
I don't know. I don't know if I said that.
No, I'm not quoting you. Someone said that to me.
Oh, I don't think it cursed me. It was weird in a way that, you know, when you're at the top of the pop charts for 7 weeks, it's all sniper fire up there, man. It's all the secular artists are trying to gun you down. You know, all the secular press is trying to tell you you're a child molester for writing a song about a young girl, and all the Christian media are trying to tell you that you sold out to the devil. And that was kind of rough, you know. And I had a long plane ride one time with Pat Boone, of all people, who's an old friend of mine.
I was going to say, that is a long plane ride when you're sitting beside Pat Boone.
Yeah, but he had a lot of wisdom because he'd been, you know, years and years in the past, he'd been in that same situation. He just kind of gave me the "Bob, you'll never please everybody" speech. You know?
Yeah.
He actually kind of gave me permission to enjoy the success of this thing. And I hadn't really given myself permission to, you know, it's okay, you know, because I was raised on guilt, man, in the world of Christian music. You know, if you don't use your talents for God, God will take it away from you. And it took me a long time for me to realize that God doesn't take away gifts. Gifts are gifts. You know, no more than you would take away a gift from your child. And it was, even though it had references to Jesus and stuff in it, you know, it wasn't an evangelistic tool. I wasn't trying to stealth the gospel to the world. You know, it was a song about my child. And it wasn't even a song about fatherhood. You know, people have tried to pin me as being Father of the Year and speak at all these family seminars, and I have diligently and completely dodged every one of those offers because I'm not a perfect father, and I don't want to stand on a stage and tell somebody what the right way is to raise your kids, you know, and I don't want to be pinned politically or anything else to a notion, you know, leave me alone. And so I said, it's a song about gratitude, not fatherhood. You know, well, I've done wrong. I must have done something right to deserve this. I'm a schmo, and yet God gave me this. That's what the song's about, you know.
So
everybody came and wanted me to get on the pro-life, the pro-this, the pro-morality, the pro-father, the pro-this and that. And, you know, that's cool if they feel like that's their calling. And I'm not saying I disagree with their stance, but I just don't want to politically align myself with anybody because I think it is distasteful to the notion of a song.
Yeah.
I think it ruins a song to exploit it that way.
Yeah, well, good for you. I mean, I admire that. There's too many people running around looking for mirrors and to be the next poster child for X, Y, or Z. So good for you.
Well, it's all about money. It's all about dollars, man.
Yeah.
It's all about, you know, how can I possibly, what can I possibly do to get my song heard more and more, and my name said more and more, and my picture placed more and more places? What can I possibly do? Who can I possibly align myself to get more fuel in my bus? What can I possibly do? If you really boil it all down, I'm not by any means trying to pin somebody on what their heart's desires are, but nine times I've seen the workings of this stuff, and nine times out of ten it's all about getting it out there. You align yourself with whoever's got the most distribution, you know. And I never really fell into that much.
In the alley behind Rosie's, you cried out, "God, I don't care where you lead me, just get me out of here. I will wash cars with Joy for you." By the way, who is Joy?
Yeah.
And how does your wife feel about that? "I will do anything just to know that I'm putting one foot in front of the other in your precious will again." So
that was it.
Bob, if you were to drop down on your knees today in the alley behind Rosie's, what would your prayer say today?
Well, assuming Rosie's is still there, it probably burnt down.
You're wrecking a good story here, man.
the same. At that time, I was really just didn't know where I was going. I was so wanting to put one foot in front of the other in my faith again. It wasn't about putting one foot in front of the other in music necessarily. It was about music was a part of my life, and I just wanted to. I was just spinning my wheels, and I was so fried. And so I have a small family, and you know it's honorable to go out there and make a. Do what you got to do to make a living. I don't cast a dark light on anyone who's out there playing in nightclubs and playing secular music and trying to make an honest living. That's an honorable thing to do, but it was just killing me at a certain point because I'd done it for so many years. I finally, just one night, I just had to step off stage and walk out in the alley, and I just said, "That's it."
Yeah.
That's it. I'm done with this whole pursuit. It's going nowhere. And I just completely let go and said, God, do something, anything. I'll wash cars as long as I got that feeling in my heart again that I'm putting one foot in front of the other toward good and right in my life.
Hmm.
And that's all it was. It's pretty really simple, but it was very, very strong. I remember that night completely. It was a real turning point in my life.
Boy, you've got the best manager. For who you are and how you're wired, you need a patient dude.
Yeah, he's a great manager. Ray and I, Ray Ware, artist management, he and I have been together for 26 years.
Yeah.
And I've just cleaned his clock. He has no idea. We have no contract.
You kill me. Oh, my goodness.
He went in for the whole handshake thing.
Yeah.
Know, so.
Sucker.
Well, whatever.
Sucker.
Whatever.
You know, if he can handle Stonehill, I guess you're just a walk in the park, really.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, he's always putting out fires, and doesn't get paid for it that much.
Hey, I know that your father was your greatest spiritual influence, right?
Yeah, he was.
So I know that meeting cool people isn't that cool for you because you had this kind of cool dad, this guy who was a good influence, a good role model, whatever. But you have met a bunch of interesting people, right? Celine Dion, Larry King, Rush Limbaugh, Ray Ware. No, that shouldn't be there. Jay Leno, Rick Dees, Terry Bradshaw. But the one I want to ask you about the most, Charlton Heston.
Yeah, Chuck.
Man,
Charlton Heston. We were doing Oprah, and it was a Father's Day show, and it was geared toward fathers. And Charlton Heston and I were splitting the hours, half an hour me and half hour him, or however it worked.
Wow.
And he had a book that just come out. And I think it was like To Be a Man or How to Be a Man or something. A book he'd written for his grandson, and I just remember being on his set with Charlton Heston, and he would just, bless his heart, man, he was just sitting backstage in a chair with his head down. He's just out like a light, you know. And so it was like, you remember the ride? No, you didn't grow up there at Disneyland. He used to have a ride called Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, and it was this animatronic Lincoln that would just suddenly come to life and start talking. It was kind of like that, man. Somebody go, Mr. Heston, and whoop, he was up, and so anyway. I wanted so bad, I never did it, and I cursed myself for not doing, but I so bad wanted to, in a moment where we're backstage together, just to look at him and say, so where's your God now, Moses?
Yeah, I bet you no one's ever said that to him before, especially not
where's
with
your
all
God
the,
now,
especially not with all the guns the guy has, you know? Jeez.
But it was interesting, man. He was a good guy. He just seemed like he was just up for the moment. And when nobody had anything that they wanted to do with him, he just went back into sleepy time. And it was
sleepy
an
time.
Amazing thing, man. Nice guy. Great guy.
Oh, man.
He said one thing to me that I'll never forget. And this is a time when Princess Diana had just died in that terrible car wreck in Paris. Now, I'm not advocating what he said. I'm just the messenger.
Thanks for the disclaimer there, Bob. Appreciate that.
You bet. He said someone had asked him. On the air, Oprah had asked him. Someone had asked. I did a couple shows with him. Terry Bradshaw had a daytime TV show, too, and I think Terry Bradshaw had asked him about the whole, because you're running for the press, the whole tabloid media thing and how they're hounding artists and how it could be dangerous. And they asked him because he's a real senior figure in nobody's had more press than Charlton Heston, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. They said, how did you handle it, Charlton, when you were, you know, in the complete limelight and you were household word? And he said, I've learned, number one, that you don't run from the press. You give them your time, you smile, you give them a few moments, you don't run for them. He says, but if you decide to run from them, one always wears his seatbelt.
Dude. Oh. Where's your publicist now, baby?
Where's your publicist now, Moses?
See.
Floor, we always wear a seatbelt.
Oh, man. No wonder he went from splitting the Red Sea to splitting the Oprah show with you.
Indeed.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I met a lot of interesting people, man. It was quite a ride, you know. It was lots of fun. I don't know if I want to do it again. Like I said, I understand what a suicide rate is, what it is in contemporary pop world, you know, because these people are so young, and it's so easy to believe your own press, man, because when I was at the top of the pop charts, everybody's feeding this stuff to you, man. You're everything. You're the man. Nothing wrong can ever happen to you. You're king of the world. You are it. You're the one. People bow down and worship you. You're it. We're, you know, we're flying here and we're flying there. You got your own jet. Here we go. Here we go. And, you know, and suddenly the people who were just licking your nostrils are now down the hall licking the nostrils of the next flavor of the month. Yeah. They're not hanging around you anymore. And you go, whoa, I thought I was God. I thought I was everything. Well, you were until you weren't. I have a great phrase that I use with record companies, you know. They love you till they don't.
Yeah.
You're family until you're not. I used to get these birthday cards from record companies. It was so, man, beautiful, big birthday cards signed by everybody at the record company, from the top brass down to the radio department, down to everybody in the record company would sign, happy birthday from your family at blah, blah, blah records. Yeah, until suddenly you're not with them anymore, and there's no more birthday cards. So I guess apparently you're family until you're not.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a weird head trip, man. I can only imagine.
It's so easy to believe your own press, man, that you're it, that you're the greatest, you've accomplished the greatest living feat on earth, because you're in a business that is designed for hype and to turn something into nothing or nothing into something, both. And I was glad that, you know, I was in my 40s, early 40s when this all happened to me, so I was pretty grounded in my family, my wife and my kids.
Yeah.
It wasn't all that fun, you know, to see everybody, the calls start to diminish after a few years, but that was never the center of my universe. But I can understand, you know, the Kurt Cobains of the world, where you're riding high on substance and BS.
Yeah.
And suddenly it moves on without you, and I can understand why you just, how you would define your life by your chart position, you know, and I think young kids really know how to do that. And I really had a grasp on it, at least enough to not buy into the whole chili, you know.
Good. Good for you. And I think that means the odds are better for Brooke and for Evan. I mean, even Jackie putting up with you, you know, that's got to
be. Oh, yeah. Yeah, my kids still like me despite my very best efforts to ruin their lives.
No. Yeah, I found it that our kids started doing much better once we put them into foster care.
Really helps.
Yeah.
Yeah, we considered a very, very, very late-term abortion for my son.
Oh, gee.
Like 16?
Yeah, 16. Oh, man. Hey, Bob, listen. This has been something I've looked forward to for a lot of years. You were a hard guy to track down because Ray's not real good at returning calls.
I know
he's the love of my life as well. Okay.
He's old, man. We're all old. We're old people. It's a big thing to get up and get to the phone.
Yeah. Yeah. Tony Campolo said to me, you know you're old when your wife yells downstairs to come up and have sex and you say, look, I can't do both.
Yeah. There you go.
Bob, thanks, man. It's just been great to hear your guts. It really has.
Thanks for just laying out a little honesty and normality in the midst of a whole lot of hype.
Thanks, dude. Appreciate it, Bob. One of these days, maybe we'll meet, eh?
I would look forward to that.
Oh, stop it. Stop.
I would.
That's just hype and what was it again?
BS and
BS,
drugs.
Substance and BS.
Whatever I've done here today, I'll fix it and I'll pay for everything.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Take care, Bob.
All right, buddy.
Bye-bye. Bye. Bob Carlisle on The Drew Marshall Show. Of course, everyone knows this song, Butterfly Kisses. Up next, the widow of author-speaker Mike Iaconelli, Carla Iaconelli, will join us. And later in the show, we've got a Journey segment. Humble Howard from Toronto. He's a big radio guy here in Toronto, folks. And Valerie Bure, former NHL player and contestant on CBC's Battle of the Blades, will join us. We'll find out how they're doing. They're on TV again Sunday night at 8 o'clock, folks. Make sure you vote for them. Well, let's have a listen to this song, eh? Mr. Bob Carlyle and Butterfly Kisses.
Looking like her mama, a little more every day. One part woman, the other part girl.
I love your directness, so I'll listen to the show again.
From ribbons and curls, trying